Hello, this is the Step Up Podcast. I'm Raoul Reynolds. I'm so bored of the EU debate that I'm bored of hearing how bored people are about the EU debate. See, I've only just started and I'm boring myself. Believe me, I didn't want to do a podcast on this subject, but I think for pro bono publico, for the public good, if you're going to give an opinion, then it should be well researched, not just a half-baked, rushed, knee-jerk opinion. So after a torturous few days of research, here it is, my podcast on the United Kingdom's EU referendum. Listen and enjoy, or use it as treatment for insomnia. Either's fine with me. So this is an extremely complicated and convoluted topic. First thing I would say is ignore anyone who is vehemently shouting for in or out, and avoid, by all measures, the official Brexit and Remain campaigns. That's the campaigns that are trying to persuade us to exit the EU or remain in the EU. The great Irish poet W.B. Yeats said, "The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity." When people are overzealous and angry, they make exaggerated, shallow arguments. Anyone speaking completely aligned to one agenda most probably has a far more nuanced and complicated view, but they're just towing the party line. And it appears public debate has reached the stage where any showing of deeper, nuanced, intricate opinions is viewed as a way of weakening an argument. So everyone just goes in all guns blazing and talks about the possibility of war or further economic collapse, or tells you you're being mugged off, anything to try and trigger an emotional response to get you invested in their position. This gets us nowhere. We just get left in this repetitive debate where both sides make the other out as extreme or dangerous to play into people's fears, their baser instincts. Now, we're only a minute or two in, and if you can't be asked to listen to the rest of this podcast and just want my conclusion without having to endure this yawn orgy, here's the short version. My gut reaction before I actually did my research was to vote in. I came to this conclusion simply by looking at the main characters on each side of the debate. Both sides are people I dislike and distrust, and both sides are funded by big corporate interests. The In campaign is supported by David Cameron, our Prime Minister schooled at Eton College, and the Brexit campaign's main pimp is Boris Johnson, the former Mayor of London, also schooled at Eton College. So this debate over whether to leave the EU or not, you know, to get our sovereignty back, it's a debate that's really about one set of Etonians battling another set of Etonians over which Etonian will get sovereignty and therefore govern the country. The In campaign is supported by Goldman Sachs, one of the widely pronounced evilest corporate entities out there, and the Out campaign is supported by the majority of the wealthy media owners. Over 80% of UK newspapers are owned by five right-wing billionaires. Lord Rothermore owns the Daily Mail, Rupert Murdoch, of course, owns the Sun and the Times, and the Barclay brothers own the Telegraph. Now, interestingly, all of them use tax havens to avoid and dodge UK taxes. And yes, you guessed it, the EU wants to confront, and is arguably the only entity with the ability to properly confront, tax havens. So, of course, those British newspapers are trying to persuade you to leave the EU. It benefits their owners directly and personally. Just this week, the EU Commission announced new measures to tackle tax avoidance and evasion by multinational corporations. So there's one difference between the In and Out campaigns. The political figures and parties I most respect, or at the very least, usually find myself more aligned to, i.e. the Green Party and more recently the Labour Party, you know, the ones that care about people and the environment, are both for staying in. The journalists I respect the most, the scientists, philosophers and intellectuals I respect the most are all for staying in. Jeremy Corbyn, who I not so long ago did a podcast about, is a lifelong Eurosceptic, but in this current political climate, he is also for staying in, for reasons I'll discuss later. So if I was lazy, and believe me, I am lazy, I would have voted yes just based on that mandem. But you bastardly incessant lot have forced me to delve deeper. In all seriousness, I didn't want to make such an important decision just going on my gut instinct. So I forced myself to do a shit ton of research over the last few days. It's been long, it's been a slog. And seriously, as a result, even just the words EU or Brexit now trigger the same bodily reaction as listening to Maroon 5, sheer insufferable anger. But I'll take my own advice from the last few podcasts I've done on meditation, and I'll take a few deep breaths, I'll calm down, and let's get stuck in. First, I'll say a little bit about the EU's formation. Before the EU, Europe had been riddled with war for centuries. Honestly, for bare time, it was by a long way the most blood-drenched continent. No matter what page you turn to of European history, there is war. Geezers stabbing geezers with bayonets, geezers invading each other, geezers murdering kings, armies of geezers butchering other armies of geezers, sheer geezer massacres. The warring European geezer of the centuries has been busy. The European Union was initiated after World War II with the aim of ridding European nations of war altogether, and after Nazi Germany was defeated, to make sure fascism never reared its ugly head again. Its idea was to resolve everything peacefully by building a cooperative group of nations. The ideological foundation of the European project was secure peace by means of the market economy. The theory was if all countries are constantly in trade with each other, it would be too costly for businesses and hence individuals to go to war. With so many trade ties and connections through business, a European identity would surface and any ugly, emotive, xenophobic, chauvinistic forces would be quashed, repressed, stifled. Economic integration would secure peace. So basically, if I'm giving you peanuts and you're giving me raspberries and we've got a good deal going, no cunt's going to persuade us to kick the fuck out of each other because I want your succulent raspberries and you want my tasty peanuts. The French politician Jean-Omer Marie-Gabriel Monet, I'll just call him Monet from here on out, but don't get confused with the painter, was one of the main architects of European integration. Now, Monet was not a trained economist. He actually owned a brandy business, but he knew how important economy was to order and peace. A bad economy often triggers bad politics, which paves the way for the sinister forces of nationalism, classism, and racism to reign free. It was Monet's dream to mesh national economies together with their neighbours to create a web that would spread out over Europe and be more powerful than the nationalistic passions that create war. Monet knew that integration and equality were central to a European Union. He said, "Equality is absolutely essential in relations between nations as it is between people." And his creation has unequivocally secured peace in Europe since. It's also helped to create a European identity. Furthermore, on the subject of peaceful community, the European context helped prevent the Catalan and Basque questions in Spain from becoming tribal and fervent. Hungary and Romania both ardently contested each other's rights to that bit of land known as Transylvania, but again this quarrel was halted from turning violent as no country is allowed to import a tribal quarrel into the EU. The truth is, after its inception, the EU has assisted in the transformation of 13 former dictatorships. Greece, Portugal, Spain, and others got rid of their dictators, knowing they wouldn't be able to join the EU with a despotic form of government. There's no doubt the EU has formed a peaceful and more democratic continent. But that's not to say there are no negatives to the EU, because I really don't think that this is a simple black and white question or answer. For all its successes, the EU itself actually has a lack of democracy and transparency in how it works. I'm not one of these blinded in or Bromain supporters who think the EU is this perfect utopian dream. How it works as an entity is far from perfect. Looking at the EU's modern form today, I wouldn't even mind being labelled a Eurosceptic if that label hadn't been tarnished by borderline racist nationalistic arseholes like Nigel Farage. There are many valid reasons to be sceptical of how the EU operates, and not everyone who opposes it is ignorant or xenophobic. So if we're talking pros and cons about the EU, I'm now going to concentrate on some cons about how the EU works. It suffers from many of the problems we have on a national level: lobbying, That's the corporate interference and bribery in lawmaking. The formation of monopolies. That's the huge corporate entities that destroy smaller businesses. And it also harbours tax-dodging elites. Like our government in the UK, the EU is saturated with a moneyed class, looking after their own interests instead of those of its people. A clear example is that many of the EU's employees have extortionate wages, benefits, and expenses, thousands of them even earning more than our Prime Minister. Another downside to the EU is it encourages policies of austerity, like the slashing of public services that the Tories are currently presiding over here in the UK. Privatising of rail networks is just one current example. The EU is urging national governments to sell off their public services, or at least what's left of them. This means the institutions that citizens have built with their taxes are sold off to private companies to profit from, all in the name of competition. This neoliberal economic outlook has pervaded the whole continent, even though it's not new or liberal. If you want to learn more about austerity, check out my podcast that I did on it last year. But to add a little balance to this section, though, and one thing we touched on that in that austerity podcast, is as the UK has its own currency, it has better standing to dismiss EU pressure to privatise and marketise. Jeremy Corbyn has promised to renationalise the railways right in the face of the current EU pressure to privatise, if he gets into power. But of course, under our current Tory government, that isn't going to happen. They'd happily profit off your private parts, pal, if you didn't keep them tucked away in your pants. The biggest and most worrying fundamental problem with the EU, though, is its lack of democracy. In the UK, if we don't like a government, we can vote against them in 5 years' time. Not ideal, but it's something. In the EU, there isn't a way of effectively rejecting a government, of rejecting the course of politics and policy. This is because the current form of European governance is such that there is no government as such. Confused as such? I won't go too deep on this because it's long, but basically, very basically, here's how the EU works. Every country pays a membership fee to be in the EU, enabling them to vote on European laws. But the laws that each country's elected MEPs, i.e. ministers of the European Parliament, vote on aren't constructed by them. They're constructed by people in the European Commission. The European Commission is where laws are invented or proposed, yet it is made up of civil servants, i.e. people who are unelected, unaccountable, and to make matters worse, some of whom are openly contemptuous of any moves for the Commission to be democratised. So the MEPs in the European Parliament can't propose law themselves and can only be held accountable personally, but not as a group. So basically, all these MEPs just end up blaming each other for any lack of progress or bad decisions, and they all go back to their nations and they say to their individual media outlets that they did their best job. The European Parliament is also riddled with lobbyists. Now, one of our greatest recent politicians, Tony Benn, suggested five little democratic questions to ask your government officials to test whether you live in a democratic society. And if you cannot find the answer to any of these questions, it is posited that you don't live in a democracy. The questions are as follows. Oi, what power have you got? Where the fuck did you get it from? In whose fucking interests do you exercise it? To whom are you accountable, you fuck? And how the fuck can we get rid of you, / get you to fuck? Now, just to clarify, I've added some modern lingo in there. But with the European Commission, these are seemingly unanswerable. We cannot simply get rid of those unelected European commissioners, those ones that make the laws. Now, Monet, that early EU architect, would despair quite a bit because this means parts of the EU are not genuinely community-based democratic organisations. Bugger. But to keep things in perspective, the EU is more democratic than the United Nations, for instance. That's another entity that the UK is a member of. The UN, however well respected it is as an entity on the global scale, includes non-democratic governments within its members. It's important to add which direction things are moving in as well. It's not all doom and gloom. The latest research states that the EU is becoming more democratic, with representation and transparency on the increase. They're getting their act together. The last glaring and ugly negative about the EU I shall talk about is how it's treated Greece over the last few years. And this can only be described as a travesty. In 2015, Greece was crushed by bank closures and monetary asphyxiation in response to its crippling debt. The EU and the International Monetary Fund forced Greece to accept loans that were basically illogical, in that they weren't going to be able to be paid back, and they forced Greece to accept nasty changes like cutting their government funding to vital public services. This led to a disastrous outcome for the Greek people. British Democrats, like Democrats everywhere, were outraged. Decent British people, like decent people everywhere, were outraged. Now, with this lack of democracy and this harsh treatment of bankrupt countries, I'm not portraying the EU in a great light at the moment. And one's immediate knee-jerk reaction could be to say the EU's lack of democracy and the EU's treatment of Greece is a reason to get the hell out of the EU. Well, firstly, I think it's important to see what the worst affected have to say about our forthcoming decision. Yanis Varoufakis, the former Greek finance minister and pretty much a hero of the Greek people for standing up to the EU, he says that the UK leaving the EU would not be an act of solidarity or a way to oppose the injustice done to Greece. Why? Well, if you're in a friendship group and some of your friends start singling out and bullying one of your other friends, do you just get up and leave? Do you leave the kid to fend for himself against the bullies? Britain should vote to stay in the EU in order to confront the brutal austerity that it enforced on Greece, to make sure that doesn't happen again. We must confront the EU's lack of democracy from within. We are in a far better position than Greece to demand change to EU structure and address its lack of democracy. And there are now European-wide campaigns and groups that are making these very demands for change. These groups are growing fast. European citizens everywhere are grouping together. We should join them. More on these groups at the end. Also, and again more on this at the end, perhaps the biggest immediate reason not to abandon the EU is that it'd be our Tory government that would preside over the restructuring of Britain. And you can safely say that most of the ills of a lack of democracy in the EU would not be solved by the Tories taking over the reins. That'd be like Judas handing over the reins to the devil himself. In this day and age, we shouldn't be voting for anything that isolates ourselves, that cuts ourselves off. Because all of the big problems facing the UK are demonstrably international problems. Whether it's the refugee crisis, climate change, terrorism, global corporate tax dodging or lobbying, these are all things that transcend small nation boundaries. We must address them by cooperating with our neighbours in Europe. We're safer and better equipped to combat these forces in the EU because we can share intelligence and resources with other countries more easily. The terrain of our struggle is a European one, a worldwide one. We cannot ignore the terrain. There are many articles, videos and interviews that list the great many things that the EU has achieved for society. So I won't spend too long on this. But for social justice, for freedom of movement, for the environment, it has been a great success. Trust me, the EU is a bad man thing. I'll just start by concentrating on the environment. Among some of the biggest changes brought by EU membership is the protection of the environment, which has often been heavily resisted by UK governments. That's to say, the EU has brought in environmental protection that our own governments would have willingly bypassed. The Union has the strongest measures for wildlife and habitat protection in the world. And all you animal lovers, all you veggies, all you vegans take note, the EU has enhanced animal welfare in food production too. It's restricted waste removal to landfill and has promoted a continent-wide recycling culture. It's banned bee-killing pesticides and acted on air pollution. It's achieved cleaner beaches and rivers. Almost two-thirds of the country's bathing waters now meet the new excellent standards set by the EU. What about in the sphere of science, surely one of the most trusted areas of society? What have the geeks and the nerds got to say? Scientists are overwhelmingly in the Remain camp. The EU funds incredible scientific research and industrial collaboration, including most recently a project that is bringing us closer to beating breast cancer. Some of the major projects at the forefront of medical science hugely benefit from the EU. Scientists value not just the good funding, but the easy collaboration and cooperation that occurs throughout Europe. It enables the best minds to come together and work for a better world. Lastly, some other small benefits the EU has brought us are things like cheaper air travel and mobile phone charges, plus better maternity pay and holiday pay. So in many ways, the EU has been a great aid to social and environmental progress. This is often ignored, though, in favour of dodgy reasons and lazy rhetoric to persuade us to vote out. I'll address some of these now. Those that say we don't want anything to do with Europe because it's a club of power-hungry capitalists, a den of corporate interests, a haven for the tax-dodging elite, well, yes, it can be. But the news I have for you is you're also describing the UK, the Tory government. There is a great deal of discontent with policies of austerity, which is often blamed on the EU, on the bureaucrats in Brussels. Sometimes this is the case, but often it's been the EU that has played a moderating role, i.e. making harsh policies less harsh. It put the Tories on a leash, so to speak. And as I've said before, if we leave the EU, people are going to be mightily disappointed as prospects will get far worse under our Tory government than any better. The last thing we want is Tories off a leash, with nothing to rein them in. We could wave goodbye to many of our public service budgets, including the NHS for one. A lot of rhetoric attempting to persuade us to vote leave is quite simply false. Tory MP Michael Gove said, "Anyone with a EU passport, even if they have a criminal record, can breeze into Britain." Mr. Gove here is actually chatting breeze. EU citizens can be refused entry for reasons like public security and public health. 1,800 EU citizens were refused entry in 2015. I also recently sat through Brexit the Movie, which is on YouTube. Although it's presented as a slick documentary, in many parts it was quite an infuriating watch, full of misleading claims and spurious assertions. One segment, called Regulated People with Regulated Lives, tells viewers how many stupid EU laws there are regulating various everyday objects. It had someone waking up in a bed as the voiceover asked, mockingly, "You wouldn't think you'd need a law for pillowcases." It points out that there are 5 EU laws just for a pillowcase and 109 EU laws for a pillow. Its aim, made in this sort of demeaning way, is to persuade you that we are being governed over excessively. There are hundreds of laws limiting both business and our lives. The narrator continues sarcastically, "You can't be too careful with duvets and sheets," as it claims to show you how many laws there are for those items. Now, my immediate reaction was, hold on, we should be a little bit careful, shouldn't we? I mean, we don't want cheap, flammable materials used for our duvets. I, for one, don't like being burnt to a crisp whilst in bed. But unfortunately, the movie never goes into any detail on any of these regulations which they're deriding. I wonder which specific regulations they're taking a disliking to. Is it the product safety requirements, the ones that protect us? Is it the environmental improvements, the ones that cease wasteful, badly designed products? Perhaps what they oppose is regulations within EU Decision 376, 2010, which specified that duvets mustn't be flammable, poisonous, or made of unhygienic animal products, liable to infect the user. EU regulation also states, duvets for children shall not comprise cords or loops that could entangle the child's neck. Are these the regulations the Brexiters are ridiculing? I mean, we all want to strangle a child with a cord on a duvet every now and then, but the rope industry can provide us with a far more appropriate murder accessory. Furthermore, the number of EU laws the movie quotes relating to each item are completely untrue. The film's next complaint is, how they've managed to think up 31 laws for toothbrushes is beyond me. A little bit of research on my part led me to the journalist Gabriel Weber, who points out, it's beyond me as well, because it's completely untrue. It's not too hard to work out what Brexit the Movie has done. It's gone into the European law database, Eurlex. It searched for various items and quoted the number of results it got for each one. But this calculates the number of laws mentioning each item, not regulating each item. With this movie, the Brexit campaign treats you as stupid. They think enlisting all these quasi-excessive laws, they can trigger some emotional response from you, to anger you at this overprotective, supposedly mollycoddling EU, this interfering nanny state. One final bit of Brexit rhetoric that frustrates me is the incessant promotion of British values. As if British values are somehow separate or more upstanding than other countries' perceived values. We need to take back our sovereignty and reinstall British values. We hear this all the time. What exactly are British values? For me, there are only universal values. Things that we perceive as morally, socially, environmentally valuable, and things that we perceive as not. What do I value? I value humanism, human rights, community, environmentalism, philosophy, our common heritage, our art, our music, our shared histories. These are things that not just British people value, but people throughout Europe and throughout the world value. Stop trying to isolate people by labelling their values by their geographical position. As Socrates said, I am not an Athenian or a Greek, but a citizen of the world. So earlier I mentioned how we must stay in the EU to change it. I believe those that say we cannot change it or that it's too late are wrong. Even the EU itself acknowledges the popular perception that EU governing bodies suffer from, and I quote, a lack of democracy and seem inaccessible to the ordinary citizen because their method of operating is so complex. They are aware. In addition, the European Citizens Initiative has been created and council sessions have been made public to improve citizens' information. This is obviously just the very start, but it clearly shows the understanding is there. The direction that the good ship EU is facing is now the right direction. We just have to start fucking rowing. Yanis Varoufakis, the former Greek finance minister that I mentioned earlier, believes that Europeans can unite to collectively demand many achievable changes to the EU. Simple things like meetings should be live streamed. The European Central Bank meetings should record and publish their minutes. Things that increase transparency straight away. This gives us the ability to create an informed population. It disempowers those politicians whose agendas are against the interest of the majority. Another reason to stay in the EU to help change it, and something that neither side seems to acknowledge, is the possibility that a vote to leave the EU could trigger the EU's complete disintegration altogether. Neither side offers any analysis of what such a disintegration will mean for Britain. Will Britain be better if the EU collapses? We'd see the divisions of markets, a return to selfish, isolationist national policies that would leave gaps for ultranationalism, and the toxic neo-fascist parties will gain power in the face of certain economic woes. I know the last thing that Brexit voters will be thinking of will be how their decision affects the rest of Europe. But British voters should not think that their decision will leave the EU unchanged or unscathed. The times we are in are financially delicate. We're still recovering from the biggest global financial crisis since the 1930s, and our still struggling economy provides a landscape of fear and hopelessness. In these climates of little hope, people become desperate and turn to more extreme measures, or they don't vote at all, and this paves the way for evil forces. This climate will only benefit the dangerous, bigoted, far-right parties that are already on the rise. The Freedom Party in Austria, Golden Dawn in Greece, Alternative Deutschland in Germany, Britain First, the BNP, even sections of UKIP here in the UK, Le Front National in France, Party for Freedom in Holland. They all use the language of hate. None lie too far ideologically from the outlook of the Nazi. They're all fucking horrible bastards, basically. To leave Europe now with these ugly groups on the rise could be disastrous. Britain has its own currency and is therefore powerful. We are in a much stronger position to apply pressure to change the EU than countries that have the euro. So we must stick together across national borders to fight shoulder to shoulder with our neighbours in order to democratise the EU through an almighty confrontation with its current inane authoritarian rulers. That early EU architect Monet once said, "We have to unite Europe because the alternative is that our skirmishes, our wars, our insults that have characterised Europe in the past will continue for the next 1,000 years. It's not enough that the Second World War is over. Unless we build a new world, the danger of war will hang over our heads." Throughout modern history, economic distress has stoked the politics of fear, anger, and irrationality. This was never more true than during the Great Depression, which heightened the economic misery of war-torn nations. It undermined democratic governments and incubated fascism. The EU is like a house that's beginning to catch fire. Should we leap out of the house, abandoning all within, or should we try to put the fire out, help the other inhabitants, and rebuild the house? If we stay in, then we can fight to democratise the current structure. If we leave, we cut ourselves off and we create a blueprint for a state that values being cut off. The views of Nigel Farage, Katie Hopkins, Rupert Murdoch will suddenly be given respect and precedence. It's impossible to pin one's hopes on a radically improved Britain, unburdened by the undemocratic sides of the EU, when it will be Boris Johnson and Michael Gove, the worst of the Conservative Party, that will be filling the void of EU laws and paving the way for a new independent Britain. Yeah, that's right, things are bad now with Cameron in charge, but with a Leave outcome, there would be a Conservative leadership crisis. The polls are already saying people think Cameron will have to resign following a Brexit win. And Tory MPs themselves are saying things like Cameron would be toast within days or won't last 30 seconds after an EU defeat. So who would clean up and restructure our country in the aftermath of a yes vote and a resigned Prime Minister? Boris Johnson would be the favourite for the job, having led the Brexit side. In an environment of similar and mechanical politicians, Boris Johnson's contrived image of a muddled, clumsy, cheeky, personable chap means he gets more respect from the general populace than the average politician. But do not be fooled. This is a man who has an unswerving devotion to corporate interest, greed, and his own ego and career. He doesn't even believe in equality as a concept. I quote, "I stress, I don't believe that economic equality is possible. Indeed, some measure of inequality is essential for the spirit of envy and keeping up with the Joneses. Like greed, it is a valuable spur to economic activity." He's wildly out of touch with the rest of us. He once described his £250,000 payment for writing a weekly column in The Telegraph as chicken feed. £250,000. Chicken feed. If you want to leave the EU because you think it's simply a conduit for corporate interest, I'm afraid to inform you, so is our Tory government. Workers' rights, for one, will be decimated by a government led by Johnson. We'd see the continuing, if not deepening, of the neoliberal monetary policies of austerity that keep people in debt and out of work. We'd probably see lowering wages to increase corporate profits, less employment regulation, fewer constraints on business, and the suffocating of our public services. Even John Major, the former Tory Prime Minister, has said that the NHS would be as safe as, and I quote, "a hamster in the presence of a hungry python," if Boris Johnson, Michael Gove, and Ian Duncan Smith rose to power following Brexit. All right, I'm almost fucking done. Finally, with the UK outside the EU, if we wanted to continue trading with Europe, we'd still have to adhere to many of the EU's rules. European industry and trade standards, workers' standards, environmental standards, these are all decided at EU level. So the UK leaving would basically just give us no say at all in rules that would still apply to the UK. So the funny thing is, in terms of trade and market, we could arguably become less democratic leaving the EU, as we'd have no say at all in the laws we'd be forced to implement to stay buoyant in the market. Right, I've rabbited on for quite long enough, and I'm losing the will to live. So to conclude, and to hark back to Monet once more, nothing lasts without institutions. The EU can become a more democratic institution. If we want to protect ourselves from those hell-bent on destroying our public services, we can enshrine institutions with progressive mission statements. We shouldn't just walk away from a struggling family. We should communicate, we should mobilise, and we should strive to fix it. Noam Chomsky put what I believe should be our mission statement for the EU very concisely and wisely. He said, "We must reverse the damage and restore the promise." Reverse the damage and restore the promise. You can call me naive, you can call me an idealist, but I'd rather fight for something with my fellow Europeans than leave our future to be written by some of the worst of our Tory party. Thank you for listening. I hope that this has maybe made at least some small part of the debate a little clearer for you, cleared something up. Further links, you can check out diem25, that's diem25.org. That's the democracy movement in Europe. There's also anotherEurope.org. Another Europe is possible. And as the name says, they think another Europe is possible. A democratic Europe, free of austerity economics, and one that welcomes refugees. Also, and perhaps one of the best resources to use, is fullfact.org. There are many fact-checking sites and organisations available now. Full Fact is doing some great stuff on the EU referendum, so you can fact-check the various statements made by each side on that site. Thank you for listening. Big up. See you soon.